Hello, this is Rush Holt, your representative, and I'm pleased to have so many of you joining this call. I'd like to get to as many of you as possible with your questions. And so first of all, let me turn to Zach Goldberg, who will explain how the call works. This is my communications director. Zach?
Yeah, and thanks again to everyone who is on the call. If you want to ask a question for Representative Holt, simply press *3 on your phone. You can do that right now. Press *3 and you will enter a queue, and soon after, one of Representative Holt's staff members will come on the line to take your name and information. You'll then re-enter the call and I'll announce your name when it's time for you to ask a question. Unfortunately, we likely will not be able to get to every question tonight. However, at the end of the call, you can leave a recording of your question for Representative Holt and he will get back to you. So again, please remember to press *3. You can do it at any time during the call. And now I'd like to hand it back to Representative Holt.
Thanks, Zach. The reason I hold these meetings on the phone and in person is because, as your representative, I need to hear from you. It's also my responsibility to let you hear from me. I need to know what's on your mind and what challenges you're facing. So, I'm sure we won't touch on all of the concerns that the 700,000 people in the 12th Congressional District have, but we'll try to get through a number of them. I'm sure that job creation and the economic plight right now is on many people's minds, no doubt the top concern. And that's why I'm focusing on, so many of us are focusing on creating small business investment, and tax credits, loans from banks so small businesses can grow and hire, because we all know that most jobs are created in the smaller companies. I've talked with lots of people who share my frustration about the reckless way that Wall Street and the big banks exploited loopholes and, well, gambled with other people's money and schemes that it turns out that they didn't even understand, and then continued to award big bonuses to themselves even as things collapsed around us. Last month, I supported the Wall Street reform as it's known. I think of that more as the Consumer Financial Protection Law. The president signed it into law, and I think it will do a lot to protect consumers and restore responsibility and accountability to Wall Street. I think it will also prevent taxpayer-funded bailouts of the financial giants. So I know that's one thing that's on people's minds. There are lots of other things. As I was responding to letters earlier this evening, there was everything from health insurance coverage for CAT scans to the situation in Gaza to physical restraint of students in schools and why we have to stop that. There are a number of big items out there, of course, the new health insurance reform legislation, the catastrophe in the Gulf brought about from really, insensitive people who were arrogant in their technologies and thought that they could drill a mile beneath the ocean without thinking about it. but there are lots of family concerns, I know, about the accessibility of college. I'm pleased that we've been able to secure the largest investment in college aid in history. There's concern, I know, about veterans health care, and I'm pleased that we've done more for veterans health care in the last 2 years than at any time in the history of the VA. And I've been working particularly hard to increase the mental health care, to improve the mental health care for veterans, something that for too long has been ignored. So there are all of those things, I'm sure, that are on different people's minds. I'll be happy to hear what's on your mind. So, Zach, do we have some questions in the queue? Or
we do. We have
email questions we could take?
Well, people are being screened. We have one who sent an email in advance. And again, just a reminder that if you want to enter the queue, please press *3. This is a question from Jeffrey in West Trenton, who is concerned about the amount of funding the U.S. government is spending on Afghanistan and Iraq, how come we are spending so much, and is this a good investment?
Well, I mean, the answer is we are spending too much for what we're getting. We've in Iraq, as so many people know, the country entered a war under false pretenses, changed the mission several times, and is now painfully but steadily extracting ourselves from that war. In Afghanistan, it was, you know, the war began to get the people who had attacked America, and well, the country then turned its attention to Iraq before the job was finished in Afghanistan, and the result is we end up with a situation that can't be contained militarily now in Afghanistan and is costing us dearly in dollars and lives. And it is, you know, that each month more people, more Americans and other NATO forces, but more Americans particularly, are dying in Afghanistan than in corresponding months before. And I think it's clear that this is not being won. We don't have a government there that is cooperative, and the problems are really partly in Afghanistan, but even more in other countries. And so we're spending well, hundreds of billions of dollars now on those wars, and not making America safer. I would like to see us building our nation here, putting Americans to work, working on the infrastructure, working in research and development, working on education here in the United States, before we put such an effort in nation building in Afghanistan. Thanks for the question.
Okay. Yeah, we have a question from Caroline in East Brunswick. Caroline? Guess she's not there.
Caroline in East Brunswick, please go ahead.
Guess we lost her. In that case, we have also from East Brunswick, Helen. Helen. Sorry, that's, we're having some problems. Frank?
I'm sorry?
Frank, go ahead.
Okay.
You had a question?
Yes. My question, as we just celebrated the 20th anniversary of the ADA, and I don't really think the law is helping the disabled in the area of employment. In particular, the person who has filed the complaint has little in resources because they're disabled, so they cannot hire a private attorney to maintain a lawsuit because the employment lawyers want thousands of dollars in retainers, and they will not accept it on a contingent fee basis. So we're dependent, and I'm one of those, dependent upon the EEOC and the New Jersey Division of Civil Rights to do the proper work and get to the right answer. And in both cases, it's not happening. I know I provided you with an email of all the detail in my case.
Yes. Well, thank you, Frank. Let me say to the callers, with regard to people's individual cases, please stay on the line and leave a voicemail at the end of at the end of the hour, if you have specific questions or problems, or call my office otherwise. But Frank, I'm happy to address that point that you raise. I think it's a good point. The ADA tried to do a number of things, some of them symbolic, but of great importance nevertheless. The Americans with Disabilities Act is now 20 years old, as you point out. And there have been, I think, enormous strides in the country. The country, for the first time, said that people with physical disabilities are truly entitled to the same rights and opportunities as every other American. And it's true that there are still barriers, legal barriers as well as physical barriers, but they are falling. They have fallen in dramatic ways. Just last week, my colleague in the House of Representatives, Jim Langevin, member of Congress from Rhode Island, who is a quadriplegic, having when he was in the high school Explorers program, he was working in the police department and a gun went off accidentally, severed his spinal cord. I don't know the details of the injury. All I know is that he is a great member of Congress, but 20 years ago would not have been able to run for office, would not have been able to serve, and he is, he has assistance, but he has, the interests of the people of Rhode Island at heart. And last week, for the first time, he was able to preside over the House of Representatives because finally the House, also now in compliance with the ADA, has the Speaker's podium, where the Speaker of the House presides over the House, accessible for a person in a wheelchair. And so Jim Langevin presided over the House, first time that has happened, first time that could have happened. And there's so many examples around the country where the ADA has opened doors for people. I agree with you that to be dependent on legal aid or public interest lawyers in order to file complaints and to get the full benefit of the law is a shortcoming. And I think we do need to address that. But thank you for that question. It certainly is worth noting the ADA. And something I often point out for... Well, in this case, we did not, the House of Representatives, the Congress of the United States, did not make the Speaker's podium accessible just for Jim Langevin, even though he's the only member of the House who is confined to a wheelchair. We made it accessible for the spirit of America. It is part of... what it means to be America, that we provide these accessibilities. So similarly, if a school has to put in special aid or elevator or whatever it is for a student, I never like to hear the school board say, we're doing it for this student. No, they're doing it for the American ideal of equality for all. Next question, Zach?
Yeah, Sue? And Sue, is South Brunswick, are you on?
Yes, I am. I had a question about the health care bill. I have a son who might not be in school after next semester, but he might be making, let's say, $7,000 a year. Will he still be eligible to be covered? He's only 22 years old. Even though he doesn't meet the IRS criteria for being a dependent?
Probably. obviously, I can't answer specific questions, specific cases about, individuals, whether it's healthcare or disability or whatever. But in general, a 22-year-old can stay on the parent's policy if she or he is not covered otherwise by health care, by health insurance. So
no matter what they make,
that would be up through age 25. And that will be, of course, partly your decision whether you want to keep your son on the policy. But the insurance companies who are required to do this in September have almost all now voluntarily begun it this summer, begun that. So check with your insurance carrier, the insurance company, and I expect that he will be that he will be covered. And give me a call if you have any other specific questions about that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sue.
Okay. Just a reminder that at any point during the call, you can press *3 to ask a question. If we don't get to your call, you can stay on to the end, and you'll be able to leave a recording.
Yeah, we're already getting lots of questions in the queue, and that's good. We'll move through them as quickly as we can here.
Okay. Jeff in East Brunswick had a question about energy, I believe.
Hello?
Jeff?
Jeff, yeah.
Hi,
please, go ahead.
I know the House passes a version of comprehensive energy reform back last year, but the Senate's been pretty much dragging its feet. So does the House leadership does the House leadership have any confidence that this issue will be addressed this year, or it's going to be pushed back to next Congress?
Well, I hope, you know, Congress has only a little over 4 weeks of scheduled session yet this year. And we have to complete our required appropriations and some other legislation for things that are going to expire. So it's going to be hard. There are a number of things that are sitting waiting to be done. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act, certainly economic stimulus and jobs programs, some things that we've passed in the House, some things that we would pass in the House if we thought the Senate would act on them. In the last year or so, I've just been throwing up my hands in despair at the very mention of the word Senate. It's where all good legislation seems to go to die. But with regard to the energy bill, the energy and climate bill, they've you know, changed it to be a more narrow energy bill in the Senate. In the House, it was a fairly comprehensive bill that dealt with limiting over time the output of carbon, as well as moving toward more sustainable domestic sources of energy, and with research and that sort of thing. Not enough research, I should say. It's but the Senate has restructured that so if they get around to passing it, it will be very different from what the House has done. We will have to go back to it again. The Senate would probably have to go back to it again because, as you know, of course, for something to become law, it has to be the same thing that is passed by the House and the Senate, the same exact language. So they have been unwilling to pass the House bill, and the Senate bill is such a kind of a shadow of what needs to be done. That I imagine there will be a lot of opposition in the House to pass something that week. So as much as I would like to see it done this year, and as much as I am pushing to get it done this year, and as much as the president is pushing to get it done this year, I think it's going to be hard. Let me turn now to an informal poll. Because you're there on your phones, you can vote by pressing digits on the keypad. Let me ask what you think is the most important issue facing the country right now. And you can press 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 for jobs and the economy. That would be 1. Healthcare, 2. The wars, Afghanistan and Iraq, 3. If you think the most important issue facing the country is energy, that would be 4. The situation in the Gulf, 5. 6 for something else. I realize this is not scientific, but I think it's interesting to see what you're thinking. 1, for jobs and the economy, 2, for healthcare, 3, for the wars, 4, press 4 for energy, 5, for the oil leak in the Gulf, 6, if it's none of those, in your mind, of what's most important.
Okay.
While people are doing that, Zach, let's go to another question. And by the way, I'll remind folks, you can press *3 to get in the queue to ask questions, although the queue is getting pretty long here.
Okay. Phil from Somerset, you had a question about Social Security.
Yes, thank you very much. Representative Holt, in your latest email newsletter, which came out July 30th, you stated that Social Security is in good shape and that it can pay all benefits through at least 2037. However, the problem is that it has now started paying out more in benefits than it receives in payroll taxes. And I think that's what everyone is concerned about. The only reason that it can be said to be in good shape is that the so-called trust fund has a positive balance projected to last until 2037. But the CBO has pointed out, and I refer to a letter of January 22nd this year, that, quote, trust funds have an important legal meaning but little economic or budgetary meaning, unquote. What they're saying, in effect, is that prior cash balances have been used for other government spending, and any current or future drawdowns of the trust fund principal and interest will add to the national debt. So the problem I see with Social Security is that it's in deficit mode today, and its deficits are projected to escalate.
Well, you seem to have a basic problem with
trust funds. Hello.
Phil. Well, the idea of a trust fund, as you point out, is a legal structure. It's not a big mattress on the mall in Washington under which we stick all those Social Security dollars. It is an obligation of the federal government to pay these benefits to people who have paid in for the 10 quarters and so forth. In its lifetime, since it was passed in 1935 and began paying benefits a few years after that, Social Security has never missed a benefit. No one has ever failed to get what they were entitled to under Social Security. And there's every expectation, I think, anybody who looks at the obligations of the federal government will say that they have every expectation of getting full benefits for the next 3.5 or more decades. Now, what happens after 2037 or whenever that date will come, and by the way, that date shifts, as economic activity picks up and more people are paying Social Security FICA taxes, if the economy is doing well, that date of technical insolvency moves back. But after 2037, or whenever that date would come, it doesn't mean that it suddenly goes to zero and nobody gets any benefits. It means that people might get 70 or 80% of their benefits instead of 100%. Well, that's not good enough. Clearly, we want people to get 100% of the benefits that are due to them. And so some changes will have to be made to Social Security in the income and the outgo. There are a variety of things that can be done. They shouldn't be done piecemeal. They should be part of a package and with some changes in the income and the outgo. This happened in the early 80s. When a commission met and made recommendations to Congress about some changes in the income and the outgo because it looked like some years in the future, Social Security would have trouble meeting 100% of its obligations. So Social Security, you'll recall, was changed so that the retirement age gradually rose to 67, which is what it's approaching now. And there were some changes in the taxing and in the benefits. Just to put in perspective, the problem that Social Security faces or will face several decades from now is the changes that would have to be made now in the income and the outgo are on about the same scale as the changes that were made in the early 1980s. And if those changes are made, just as in the early 1980s, they put Social Security on sound financial footing for, well, approximately a lifetime, 60 or 70 years, so similar sized changes, not dramatic overhaul of Social Security, can put it on sound financial footing for 60 or 70 more years into the future. So that's why I've pointed out that Social Security, I wouldn't say it's in good shape, but I would say that it is something that people can rely on and should rely on. It is one of the most important programs of the federal government.
Okay.
Next question. Yeah, thanks for that one.
Yeah, Sridharan from Monmouth Junction.
Hi, thank you. This is Sri here. I had a question.
Yes, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Yeah, I
what
had
can
a question.
What's on your mind?
We have started a business in the recession period 2 years ago, and then we have grown a business with our own funds, and then we nearly crossed over around $1 million in terms of revenue. But when we approached the bank for a loan for our expansion plans, and what we noticed is they in turn go into the SBA loans, and the SBA loan is asking for a kind of security in terms of pledge towards the house, which I feel it is we should not do it because it's kind of personal, and one partner cannot put a pledge on the house and then take the loan for expansion.
Yeah, well, on your particular, thank you for the call. On your particular case and what loans are available to you, I can't address that right now. For anyone on the call who has a particular concern about healthcare, about small business, about veterans, whatever, please call my office and give me the details of your personal case. But let me say a couple of general things that might be helpful to you, Sridharan. First of all, you should use the resources of the Small Business Administration. The SBA loans, the SBA guaranteed loans, they are predictable and understandable and often helpful. What we want to do is, put Americans back to work. And as I said, small businesses are the way to do it. A lot of Americans have lost jobs through no fault of their own. But in response to this, there have been several programs created that actually might be helpful. The HIRE Act provides businesses with exemption from Social Security payroll taxes if they hire unemployed people. There's a payroll tax exemption that should spur maybe 300,000 new jobs in the country. The small business expensing changes how you write off on your taxes, capital investments. There's also a credit for people who are in the pharmaceutical business or therapeutic discoveries. That maybe doesn't affect you. The health insurance reform law does offer immediate and long-term tax credits to small businesses who provide coverage for their employees. So there are a number of these things that are available to small businesses. There's some other things that I've been working on that will allow tax credits, enhanced tax credits for research and development, and tax credits for people who will invest in businesses that have large research and development components. So in your particular case and, whether they want your home as collateral and that sort of thing, I'm afraid I can't if I understand your question correctly, I can't deal with that specifically, but I look forward to hearing from you about it later.
Okay. Thanks for that call. Next, we have a question from Neil in Old Bridge. Neil?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm concerned,
yes, Neil,
primarily about the amount of deployments that have been ongoing for both my daughter and my son-in-law, as well as so many other soldiers, and what it's doing to both their families and themselves about this. Divorce rate.
Your daughter and son-in-law are in the service now, in uniform.
Yes, correct. They. My daughter
Is bless them. Thank you. Thank them.
Thank you so very much. My daughter has done 3 tours of duty in Iraq. My son-in-law, her husband, has done this is his 4th tour of duty. Now he's in Afghanistan, and they're both staff sergeants who have been on suicide watch many times. The suicide rate is through the roof. The divorce rate is through the roof. I'm just wondering when the conscience of the House and the Senate is going to say enough is enough. This is ridiculous.
Well, I feel for you. I hear you loud and clear. As I said earlier, the security that is being brought to America through our actions in Iraq and Afghanistan are not worth the cost. In the lives, in the actual lives lost, in the lives that are diminished, and in a number of other costs. And I have to hand it to you and to them for your sense of service, your sense of duty, and I thank you, and I thank them for this. You're absolutely right, and it's painful to talk to parents of servicemen and women to point out that the suicide rate is higher than in the general population. It is higher than the, in other words, the number of soldiers who have died at their own hand is greater than those dying in combat. And it is, it's just tragic. We have been putting, I personally, Congress in general, have been putting a great deal of attention into mental health services for those in the military and for veterans. It's not good enough. Some of you have heard the story of Coleman Bean from Milltown. That story touched me so deeply that we put forward legislation that I'm hopeful will become law soon that would require for all reservists that there be kind of the same level of attention as for those in active duty. Coleman Bean served 2 tours in Iraq, had diagnosed post-traumatic stress disorder, was seeking help. He died. He killed himself, and the VA called, about 10 days later, saying, yes, they had the appointment for him now. His parents, to their great credit, have really worked to try to help parents around the country and to change the procedures in the Army and the VA. We, as I say, have quite a bit more. A close family member has left his psychiatric practice in Massachusetts to go to Germany to work with the troops, and I praise him for that and applaud him for that. We will keep doing what we can, but as you seem to be saying, the best thing, Neil, that we could do for them is to bring them home.
Okay. Thank you for that call.
Let me take a moment. I gave you this poll question a while ago. Remember, I said it's not scientific, but you'll be interested to know what the others on the call have punched in on their keypads to vote. Jobs, the economy, healthcare, Afghanistan, so forth. 57%, so far and away the highest concern, jobs and the economy. Next, Afghanistan and Iraq, the war, 14%. Healthcare, close to that, 11%. And then in single digits, energy, other, and Gulf oil. So, guess predictably, jobs in the economy are very much on people's minds.
Okay, and just a reminder. Yeah, and before I go to another question, just a reminder, people can still ask questions. You can enter a queue by pressing *3, and if we don't get to your question, you can leave a recording at the end of the call. But for now,
in fact, let me just say, and you're always welcome to call my office. It's 609-750-9365 if you have individual questions, or you can call toll free 1-877-RUSH-HOLT. Okay, other questions?
Yeah, Lloyd from South Brunswick.
Yes. Hi. How are you? I was very concerned with the Supreme Court decision that permits corporations and unions to contribute to political campaigns. I think that's just absolutely devastating. It's going to have a major impact for years to come. Has any legislation been contemplated in the House or the Senate to try to counter what I believe would be one of the worst decisions ever by the Supreme Court?
Well, there are two different but related. There's three different but related things here. Let me talk about at least a couple of them. One is the recent Supreme Court that said corporations can spend money on political campaigns as if they were individuals, as if they had the same right of free speech that individuals have. And I think that's a terrible decision. If you look at the way that the Constitution was written and try to get your, as a Supreme Court justice, you're supposed to interpret what it means. I would ask people to try to put themselves in the minds of the people who put this together and what they were trying to do. It doesn't say we the people and the corporations of the United States in order to form a more perfect union. It's we the people. They are talking about individual liberties, the individuals banding together in order to protect their liberties and to provide opportunity for each other. And to allow corporations to contribute to buy television ads in favor of candidates and that sort of thing, I think could really pervert the system, and I expect that will happen. I think actually it will be a bigger problem in local and county elections where $100,000 or a few hundred thousand dollars, which might be a small amount of money for a corporation, could be have a huge effect on a town council or in counties. And I think we will see that sort of thing happening. The legislation that's been proposed in Congress, because of the nature of the Supreme Court decision, can't overturn the court's decision, but what it can do is call for transparency. It could require approval of shareholders or boards of directors in doing in placing such ads, things that might have some beneficial effect. The way they wrote this decision makes it very hard to change. Now, the other thing that we should do and can do is to remove excessive money from politics is to pass good campaign finance reform. And I've been a principal author working with Representative John Larson from Connecticut and Shelley Pingree from Maine and some others, actually bipartisan, to try to get limitations on campaign finance if people will opt in to the public financing. That would remove a lot of the effect of excess money in campaigns. There's several other things that I think should be done with regard to campaign finance and the procedures of campaigns, and I would add also to make sure that the voting itself is auditable, so that that's not subject to hacking or manipulation. So there is legislation in the House. The Senate, it does not seem so willing to proceed with this. So like several other things, it's stalled in the Senate right now. But thank you for the question.
All right, thank you.
Before I go on to the next question, let me again ask you to use your keypad. I like to keep constituents up to date on activity in Congress and things that I'm doing by sending periodic email newsletters. And if you'd like to receive these occasional email newsletters, you can press 1. I'll get your email address and send you these regular emails. You can unsubscribe at any time. It's painless and simple to unsubscribe. So if you press 1, I will put you on the email list for these regular updates. Will that work, Zach? Do I have that right?
Yes, you have that exactly right. And we have another question from Mahinder. I hope I got your name right.
Yes,
from North Brunswick.
Mahendra. Yeah, Mahendra.
Okay. Yes, please, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Of course, this is not the question for the entire nation. Maybe this principle can work, that the property taxes, particularly in New Jersey, are so high that we, the seniors, are really feeling the pinch of it, and when we need more money to save for medical treatment and other things, I particularly feel that there should be a law where the property taxes would not go high. They should be totally frozen at the age of 70. And owner will not have to pay anymore after age of 70.
Well, of course, property taxes are something that are determined at the state level, and they're levied by the state and local jurisdiction, I mean, by the county and local jurisdictions and the school board. Strictly speaking, a federal issue, so if there were an age 70 moratorium on property taxes and so forth, that would have to be done out of Trenton. There is one thing that we can do, and actually a few things that we can do, and let me talk about a couple of those. I mean, one thing I try to do is make sure that New Jersey gets its fair share of education assistance, whether that's for special education under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA, or for teacher professional development, that sort of thing. Anything that can be picked up at the federal level using income taxes and federal revenue will come to New Jersey's benefit and would reduce some of the pressure for school taxes at the local level. Another thing that I've done is to make sure that property taxes are deductible on federal income tax for those who don't itemize their deductions, and that's typically it's a senior, an older person or couple who own their home, who aren't making mortgage payments anymore but are still paying property taxes, that's often a situation where people are not itemizing their taxes, and being able to deduct them really does help people here in New Jersey, actually many thousands of people here in New Jersey. So those are, I could go on a little bit about indirect benefits for the high, for people who are paying these high property taxes, all of us here in New Jersey, but it's mostly not a federal issue. Zach, another question?
Yeah, we have a question from Kevin in North Brunswick. Kevin? Let's try this again. Kevin, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can hear you, please. Yes.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yes, so Representative, you have a background in renewable energy research, and actually in New Jersey there's quite a bit of work in that area. I think New Jersey leads in many ways. The question
there was
is
more, there was more a year or so ago, but yes, New Jersey is one of the most active states in non-fossil fuels or non-fossil energy. That's right.
So my question is, what's it going to take for this to get from the research out of the, let's say, our federal dollars and be a viable business where it generates jobs, for instance, in New Jersey?
Right. Well, of course, some of it is already working. I mean, research that was done 30, 20, 10 years ago is paying off, and there is quite a bit of photovoltaic energy. Now, photovoltaic energy is probably never going to be more than a fraction of the energy that we use in the United States, but it's nevertheless real, and quite a bit of it. Wind energy is competitive in many places now, and when people learn about the abundance of wind 20 miles off the shore of New Jersey, they're just really astounded. Unlike what we see on land, just go a couple of tens of miles offshore, and there is really steady, good wind, something around 20 miles an hour, and more or less steady. If it's captured with today's technology of turbines, could make a significant contribution to the electricity, in the eastern half of the United States. If you harvest that wind off of the Atlantic coastline, there are a number of other things, yet to be done. I worked for years on fusion energy, which still holds promise, but it's not right around the corner. It's, I would say, $30 billion years away. I mean, you could spend $1 billion a year researching on it, which, by the way, $1 billion is not so much in the big energy picture when we spend $1 trillion a year for energy goods and services in the United States. But, you could spend $1 billion a year for 30 years, or you could spend a third of $1 billion a year or something like that, as we're doing now, and get there in a century. Research there needs to be conducted to turn that into jobs and energy. But there are other things that are nearer term with electric drive trains in cars and that sort of thing. There's no reason why New Jersey couldn't and shouldn't be the leader in the manufacture of wind turbines. There's no reason why New Jersey couldn't and shouldn't be a leader in the manufacture of electric drivetrains for cars, in smart grid use. It's happening. In South River, I was there some months ago for the installation of smart meters that will communicate from the house back to the utility, so the utility can understand the use of energy better, and provide energy better. So there are a thousand, or in fact thousands, of different things that are at different stages of development, some of them ready for jobs right now. Energy conservation and efficiency is ready for jobs right now. It will save energy. In fact, that is the low-hanging fruit. Energy that is saved is even better than energy that is efficiently generated. So, there are many parts to the answer to your question, and it's a great question. And, the best way to reduce our deficit is to put people back to work. And in energy, in green jobs, in things that will be stamped made in America, that would be the right way to do it.
Okay. Thanks for that question.
Thank
we have
you.
Time for one or two more questions, but to those, and we have hundreds still on the call, you can... If you stay on the line for a few more minutes, you can leave a recording for Representative Holt, and he will get back to you. In the meantime, we have a question from South River and Christopher.
Hello, thank you. Mr. Holt, I'm wondering, what's the stand on unemployment benefits? Are they still going to be paid out after when the economy is going to be turning around? Because I've been unemployed for like 2 years.
Well, yes, unemployment compensation is there even in good times. But for people who have lost their job through no fault of their own, society has come to understand that it is not only the humane thing to do to see that, they can put food on the table, but it is also economically beneficial to us all, to everyone. And particularly at a time like this, with the unemployment rate in New Jersey near the national average, somewhere close to 10%, and then probably another 10% underemployed, these are tough times. And the government can help and traditionally has helped people as they seek new work. It is, as I say, particularly important now. I mean, there are those who are suggesting that if only we would reduce the unemployment benefit to, something below minimum wage level, then people would get off their duff and stop lolling around on unemployment. Well, I mean, not only is that insulting to people who have been looking for work for 2 years, it is economically counterproductive. We want people... able to stay afloat while they're looking for work. And we will continue unemployment benefits. The question is, will they be extended for people who have been unemployed for months and months and years and years? We have just extended them, and that's a good thing. It turned out to be a tough fight in Congress to get that done. And so the next time it comes around, if we are still in a sluggish recovery or in a recession and unemployment stays up, at 9 or 10 or percent or so, it's once again going to be a fight to extend the unemployment benefits for those people who have been on unemployment for a long time. In that situation with unemployment, at those high levels and the number of people who have been unemployed for a long time at record levels, I think it's incumbent on us to do that. But it was a real fight recently when we did it. Do we have time for another, or how are we doing?
Unfortunately, we don't. That had to be the last question. So,
Please stay on the line. Leave any questions or comments. I will get back to you. I'll transcribe or my staff will transcribe what you record. As I said, you can be in touch with me a number of other ways. You can phone me, 1-877-RUSHHOLT. You can go to my website, send me an email. You can send me a fax. You can send me U.S. mail. Whatever you send me, I will read it. I will consider it. I will get back to you. And I thank you all for taking part in this tonight.